Well, first of all, welcome to this rather magnificent building and this rather magnificent room. I'm almost beginning to wish I was a lawyer, because if this is what they have to put up with, I could have done with that over the last 22 years at the LSE. Fine institution it is, but architecture is not its great merit. But anyway, very welcome to you all this evening. This is the fourth lecture in this third Engelsberg series to be delivered, as you know, and I will introduce Margaret in a while. I won't read your whole CV, Margaret. It'll take longer than your lecture, I would imagine. Margaret is speaking, of course, the fourth lecture on alliances. It's been a historical tour de force. I've seen them all on the web. From the Dillon League to the First World War, to the origins of the First World War, to the end of it, to the origins of the Second World War, and tonight we'll be looking at the Grand Alliance and the victory in the Second World War. Given that you come from such a peaceful country, why do you write so much on war? And maybe that will be my opening question to you. But anyway, it's wonderful to have Margaret here, a good friend, and really brought great prestige to this lecture series. And I'd also like to make a both personal and institutional thanks to the Axon Johnson Foundation. I know one of the friends is here this evening, so thank you for the generosity bestowed on LSE Ideas. You've made possible, I think, three great lecture series, and this one tonight, I think, will not fall short of the very best we've had so far. I always like to say then quickly that this lecturer tonight needs little introduction, and Margaret McMillan, I think, was born in Canada, then did a BPhil and PhD, I think, DPhil, at Oxford, went back to Canada, then came back to Oxford. The series of books that she has written have been impressive. I would like to test you all out there, but I won't, to ask you, I think this is the right answer to the question, what was your first book? It wasn't on war, it was called The Women of the Raj, if I remember. That was based on your original research at Oxford. And I asked Margaret earlier on, when is she going to write the second volume, Men of the Raj, but she said it wasn't worthwhile. Margaret has written some wonderful volumes. I think I've probably read nearly all of them, Margaret. I said nearly, but I think I've read most of them. There's some I've got great favour. They're all so wonderful. I loved your book on Paris 1919, so interesting, so challenging. I like the fact that you don't like John Maynard Keynes too much, as you know. I kind of rather have a liking for JMK, but we have a difference of opinion about that, because you thought he wrote a rather unfair book on Versailles, and I think you're probably right, but it's still a great book that he wrote too. The book on Nixon in China is one I read a very long time ago. It doesn't get as much publicity now as I think it should. It's a great book to reflect, because so much was written, and I think that was a wonderful book. You've written about the origins of the First World War, the coming of the end of the First World War, and many, many more, and of course your Reith lectures as well. Such a fantastic compilation, such a fantastic listings of such wonderful books. And I might also say, and I'm only saying the obvious, you write so well, they are worth reading and reading again. They're absolutely wonderful. Many honorary degrees from King's College. I certainly hope the LSE steps up to the plate one day, Margaret. Hint, hint, if anybody's here who's got the power to do so. Margaret, I'm not going to say any more other than to welcome you to give the fourth Engelsberg lecture on the Grand Alliance and victory in the Second World War. I wonder if we could give her a proper LSE welcome. Margaret.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming out when you'd probably be rather at home watching this on Zoom. But for me, it's a great pleasure to actually be here in person and to be seeing an audience again. It's been a long 2 years where we haven't seen people, and it's been unfortunate, I think, that I had the chair at a time when COVID closed down the LSE partly. So I'm very glad to be here tonight, and I too would like to thank the Foundation for sponsoring these lectures, which have made me think again, which is a good thing, about what I'm doing. I'm writing about the Second World War, has made me look again at how alliances work So thank you for getting me going in the direction which I should be going. The Grand Alliance took its name from that first Grand Alliance. This is not a map of the Napoleonic Wars. It's a map of Europe and the world in 1939. The Grand Alliance reflected or echoed that much earlier alliance where the nations of Austria, Prussia, Russia, and Britain came together to defeat Napoleon. And in some ways, that earlier alliance was like the later one, that it came together under duress, it came together, brought together very different nations who wouldn't perhaps normally work together. It was constantly threatened by falling to pieces, yet somehow managed to survive and persist and bring about a victory, which would not have happened, I think, without the alliance. The forces ranged against France were divided. The forces ranged against the Axis powers were divided, or in the case of the United States, not participating. And it really was the alliance that made it possible to bring to bear the great resources of manpower in the Second World War of the Soviet Union, its natural resources, the Western allies' technology, resources, and to a lesser extent, their manpower as well. And so the combination of forces in the Grand Alliance in the Second World War of Britain, United States, Russia, was going to really be the key to victory. I think without it, it is quite possible that Hitler and his fellows in the Axis would have managed to make some sort of deals and managed to hang on to some of what they have conquered and perhaps continued in the case of Nazi Germany to dominate Europe. And so the Grand Alliance was key to victory in the Second World War. It was, as you know, one of the most improbable alliances in history. Most alliances are improbable, unexpected, brought together only because there is a single purpose that they simply have to come together for. And this is certainly the case of the Grand Alliance in the Second World War. Churchill later said, there is only one thing than fighting a war with alliances, and that's fighting without them. And I think that was a very common view. And the maintenance of the alliance took perhaps almost as much energy and resources as actually trying to defeat the enemy. And there were times, as with that previous Grand Alliance in the Napoleonic Wars, when the Grand Alliance of the Second World War was under very serious strain indeed. And of course, the question I think that we all ask, not something I'm going to try and answer tonight, is could the Grand Alliance of the Second World War, like that earlier one, have survived the war? Could it have provided the framework and the basis for cooperation among the powers that had collectively won the war? In the case of the Grand Alliance in the Napoleonic Wars, it gave birth to the Concert of Europe and did provide Europe with at least a framework and the prospect of stability, certainly up to the Crimean War. The Grand Alliance of the Second World War, as we know, fell to pieces very soon after the end of the war. And I think one of the questions we may want to keep in mind tonight is, was that bound to happen? Were the strains so great that once victory came, once the threat that had brought them together had been removed, that they were bound to fall to pieces? We can think about that perhaps later on. The alliance came together, as I say, out of necessity, and it also took, as I said, a great deal of maintenance. The maintenance of relations, often of very different nations, was a great deal of what made the alliance work. You can't just make an alliance and then expect everything to go smoothly. And I think what made a difference, as it did in that earlier Grand Alliance, was the leaders who were key in bringing it about and key in maintaining it. Now, I know that we can overstress the role of individuals in history, and what matters are the great impersonal forces of history, what matters are resources, what matters are the geographical positions of nations, what matters are all sorts of other things than the individuals. But I think we have to remember, in the case of the Second World War, as in the Napoleonic Wars, those who headed the nations involved possessed very great power indeed. And so they had the power to work with each other or not work with each other. They had the power to direct the war efforts of their country. Later, with almost unlimited power, limited only by his own capacity to actually exert that power, Roosevelt was a Democratic president, but had achieved a position of such dominance in the United States in his third and then fourth term as president. He still had to work with Congress, but he had considerable power and authority over his own military. A lot of American strategy and the whole war effort was run out of the White House, not run through the bureaucracy so much, but run through those who were close to Roosevelt. And Churchill, again, although he was a democratically elected prime minister, had, at least for wartime, greater powers than prime minister. The alliance was bound to have strains in it because the three partners in it were so different. They had different histories, they had different ideologies, their leaders had different views of what sort of world they would like. And I'll just very briefly talk about those three leaders and their worldviews, because that was going to inform very much the way they dealt with each other and the way they thought about the war when victory had finally come. Churchill was, as you know, a very complicated man, a man of very strong views, a man whose views in many ways are antithetical to views of today. He was, he said, determined to maintain the British Empire. This, to him, was one of the guiding principles. It should be remembered, I think, that this was not what everyone else in his government thought. And I think too often the Americans tended to assume that all British, particularly those in the government and in the bureaucracy, were arch-imperialists. This was simply not the case. Churchill, in this, was, I think, on the right wing of opinion in Britain. He was also someone who had, I think, great geopolitical sense. He understood history. He had a sense of how the forces might play out. He was capable of looking ahead in ways, I think, that neither Roosevelt nor Stalin were. Roosevelt is perhaps the most difficult of the three men to understand. He committed very little to paper. He tended to tell those he talked to what he thought they wanted to hear, and he tended to compartmentalize. He had people that he would show us part of himself. He was very close, for example, to Harry Hopkins, who worked for him on foreign policy, very close to Morgenthau, his Secretary of the Treasury. But he didn't work through a cabinet. He didn't work through groups, as Churchill had to. There's a story that when Roosevelt went to the opening of the Presidential Library, this was opened before his death in 1942 at Hyde Park, the family, Roosevelt family estate, someone said to him, "Mr. President, you seem to be in a very good mood today." And he said, "I'm thinking of all the people who are going to come here trying to find out something about me, and they're going to be disappointed." And I think this was true of Roosevelt. He is very, very difficult to pin down. But I think what we can say about Roosevelt is that he was a Wilsonian. He'd been in President Wilson's cabinet in the First World War. He had very much absorbed the Wilsonian ideas. He believed in a world order. He was also an American patriot. And for Roosevelt, as for many of those who advised him, the world order was something that the United States could best maintain. There was an overlap in what they saw as the new world order. And like others around him, Roosevelt was very conscious of the growing power of the United States, very conscious that when the war ended, the United States would be the dominant economic power in the world, and along with the Soviet Union, the dominant military power in the world. And so you have this overlap in the mind of Roosevelt that the United States knows what is best for the world, but what is best for the world is also best for the United States. One of the things that the Roosevelt administration was quite open about was it wanted to see the British and other European empires wound up, and they wanted access to markets and to trade in those former empires. They wanted, in other words, American business and American investment to be able to penetrate previously excluded parts of the world. And then you have Stalin. And Stalin, I think we have to understand in terms not only of his own life, we have to understand in terms of his ideology. I do not believe, a lot of people would argue that Stalin was simply a Soviet or Russian statesman like any other Russian statesman. He was concerned with the security of Russia. He was concerned with having defensible borders. He was aware of the vulnerability of Russia to invasion. He was aware of Russia's backwardness by comparison with the West. And I think if we remove ideology from Roosevelt's understanding of the world, we don't get the full picture. Yes, he did in many ways behave and think like a Russian statesman. That was simply inevitable. But he was someone who had been shaped from a very young age by Marxism-Leninism. He had a view of the world that the world was divided into the capitalist and non-capitalist countries, the forces of capitalism and the forces of revolution. And he believed that it would be inevitable one day that the capitalists would try yet again, as he saw it, to try and strangle the revolution in Russia. And I think to understand that is to understand something very important about Stalin. He did not trust and never could trust his alliance partners. He would work with them because that was the lesser evil, but eventually he thought that they would be his enemy and that the Soviet Union would have to fight them. And so you have three men with very different countries, coming from very different histories, with very different views of the world. And there were, of course, tensions that came from history between them. In the years up to 1941, which was going to be a decisive year in the history of the war because it brought Russia into the war when Germany attacked, and then, of course, at the end of 1941, the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor and the German declaration of war on the United States brought the United States fully into the war in both the Pacific and the Atlantic. In 1941, the relationship between the British and the Americans had deepened. The United States had, of course, not entered the war on the British side, but it had increasingly supported the British war effort, particularly after the summer of 1940, when the Roosevelt administration became convinced that the British would actually survive, and that it was therefore worth supporting them and worth making resources available to them, while the United States prepared itself for perhaps what it feared was going to be a war that it would have to get involved in. The Roosevelt administration and Roosevelt himself had no intention of getting the United States involved in a ground war in Europe, but they were concerned that they would have to take a greater part in the war in the Atlantic, that they would have to take possibly steps against Japan in the Pacific. They might well have to go to war with Japan. And so the relationship between the British and the Americans deepens as the Americans become, in their own way, more and more committed to the British war effort and more convinced that the British are actually going to survive. And this is something, of course, that Churchill pays a great deal of attention to. He often described himself as a suitor to the Americans, and in particular, a suitor to Roosevelt. He talks to Roosevelt, he phones Roosevelt, he sends him letters. Their combined correspondence is very large. The majority of letters are written by Churchill. Roosevelt replies more briefly. There is a correspondence from Roosevelt, but I think there's something like, I'm trying to remember the exact number, 1,100 letters from Churchill to Roosevelt, which tend to be quite long. Churchill was good at expressing himself, of course, in words. And Roosevelt's letters amount to some 700, and they're usually much shorter. But I think it was for Churchill a key relationship. And he laid himself out, which must have been difficult for someone who of course, had considerable pride, to appeal to Roosevelt as much as possible and to appeal to the Americans. And he used radio very effectively. Roosevelt was very good on radio. Churchill had a different style, but a number of his great speeches were broadcast to the United States, and he began to speak more and more directly to the American public. But that relationship was always difficult. Even in those early days, as the Americans and the British moved closer together, there was suspicion, and I talked about this in an earlier lecture. There was suspicion which came out of their mutual histories, suspicion on the part of the British that the Americans were going to take what they could from them. As Churchill said in an unguarded moment, he didn't put it in a letter, he said, they want to flay us to the skin. And I think there was this feeling that the Americans would squeeze every advantage they could out of the British and would probably try and wind up the British Empire as well. And there was a feeling on the part of the Americans that the British were not being straightforward with them, that they were exaggerating how much they needed, that they were taking resources that the Americans needed. That was particularly the view of the American army, which seems, at least until Pearl Harbor, to have been thinking mainly in terms of continental defense, whether that was invasion from Mexico or possibly my own country, Canada. It was not ever very clear. They were not thinking in terms of overseas expeditions, but gradually, only very gradually, came around to that. And then there were going to be disagreements after 1941 when the United States does become an ally over strategy, over the conduct of the war, which also reflect a growing disproportionate in the strength between the two. 1942 is probably the last year that the British and Americans are equal in terms of power, and after that, the Americans, as their enormous economy and their large population begin to gear up for war, become much the more powerful partner in the relationship. And this is something that, of course, is very difficult for the British to accept, and it's something that they're going to constantly challenge, but it is a very important fact in the relationship. General Eisenhower once said to a colleague in 1943 of the British, I am not so incredibly naive that I do not realize that Britishers approach every military problem from the viewpoint of the empire, just as we approach them from the viewpoint of American interests. But one of the constant sources of danger to us in this war is the temptation to regard as our first enemy the partner that must work with us in defeating the real enemy. And I think that is gives you a sense of the difficulties in the relationship between the United States and Britain. It was never going to be an easy relationship. Churchill in his memoirs talks about how wonderful it was, but I think he was making the best of what was often a very difficult and complicated relationship. Well, 1941, as I said, was a year in which the war changed dramatically. First of all, in June 1941, the German invasion, Barbarossa, of the Soviet Union brought the Soviet Union into war on the Allied side. It was not going to be an easy alliance. This is a picture of Molotov shaking hands with Ribbentrop when the Nazi-Soviet pact was signed in 1939. And so in June 1941, the British suddenly faced the prospect of having to deal with a country which had signed this agreement with their greatest enemy to carve up the center of Europe. And it was something that it was difficult, I think, for British public opinion and then American public opinion to overcome. But as Churchill said, he said almost the day he heard about Barbarossa, he said to one of his assistant secretaries, Jock Colville, if I had heard that Hitler had invaded hell, I would make a favorable reference to the devil in the House of Commons. And I think Churchill was utterly realistic. The Soviet Union was the necessary ally if Nazi Germany was going to be defeated. But I think he had few illusions about what it is that he was getting into. He made an immediate broadcast. He referred quite openly to disagreements in the past. He said quite correctly that he'd once had a very different view of Bolshevism. He had been, of course, one of those advocating intervention when the Bolsheviks took power after 1917. But he said, times have changed. And he offered all aid that the British could spare, and it was going to be difficult for them, to the Soviet Union. President Roosevelt in Washington 2 days later said, and this is a very Rooseveltian expression, he said, we will give all aid we possibly can to Russia. And he never specified what that was. And he waited, as he tended to do, to see how public opinion was going to react to this, and again to see how the war was going to go. Both Britain and the United States were not sure, just as the United States had not been sure with Britain earlier on, that Russia would actually survive. Because if you remember the opening moves of Barbarossa, the Germans moved in very, very rapidly to Russia. It looked like they would probably take Moscow and possibly Leningrad by the winter. And so there was a waiting period on the part of both the British and the Americans before they began to send quantities of aid to Russia. But by the autumn, both the United States and Britain had become convinced that Russia would, or the Soviet Union would, survive. And in November, Roosevelt declared that the Soviet Union was eligible for lend-lease and also gave the Soviets an interest-free zone to cover supplies that they had, a loan that they had brought earlier. And then at the end, as I mentioned, of 1941, the Japanese attacked at Pearl Harbor, and that brought the United States into the war in the Pacific. It was not clear that the United States would come into the war in Europe, although, of course, the British and the Russians desperately hoped that they would, and Hitler simply made it easy for them by declaring war on the United States. One of his more egregious mistakes, but one that was going to be absolutely crucial in determining the course of the war. Britain and the United States had already decided, they'd already by this point had extensive staff talks, and they had already decided that they would concentrate on the war in Europe first. And this, I think, was partly because they felt that the Nazi power, Germany, was the dominant power in the Axis, that Japan, and they thought wrongly, did what the Germans told them, and they thought it was much more important to defeat Germany before they defeated Japan. This was not something that their military necessarily approved of, particularly their navies, but this was going to be Allied strategy now until the end of the war. And so Germany's declaration of war, in a way, clarifies things, simplifies things, and the Grand Alliance is now fully in existence. It was never going to be, not surprisingly, an easy alliance, partly because both sides, the Western democracies and the Soviet Union, knew so little about each other. There had been so little contact between them. The Soviet Union, as a result of the purges in the 1930s, had lost much of its capacity, had lost much of its ability to analyze the world. The Foreign Office had been reorganized, and those who did understand a bit about how democracies worked, such as Maisky in London and Litvinov in Washington, had been sidelined. They were called back to Moscow and set rather dull tasks in mid-1943. and the foreign ministry was given to Molotov, who was just very much Stalin's man. Molotov did what Stalin told him, and like Stalin, he was an ideologue. One of his assistants said that Molotov reorganized the foreign ministry along Stalin's preferred lines. It reflected imperial ambitions, a strongly ideological orientation, and a tough spirit of battle. And this, I think, was going to inhibit Soviet understanding of what it was they were dealing with in the West. I think they simply didn't understand, and they didn't have the sources of information to understand how Western democracies worked. There was a very revealing moment at Yalta when there was a conversation between Molotov and an American, I can't remember who the American was, who said, you know, we have to take the Polish question very seriously because we have a lot of public opinion in the United States, a lot of people of Polish descent who care strongly about the fate of Poland. And Molotov looked in, he never showed surprise. I mean, he was stone-faced, but I suppose his stone face was as surprised as it ever was. And he said, but you must simply discipline your public opinion. And so I think there was a fundamental lack of understanding, and an understanding that was, I say, tempered very much by the ideological lenses with which the Soviet Union and Soviet leaders looked at countries like the United States and Britain. There was also very little understanding in the Western democracies of the Soviet Union, partly because so few Westerners had been allowed to live there. And those Western ambassadors who were there, particularly after 1939, had very few contacts with Soviet officials. The American ambassador, who arrived in 1940, invited Molotov to dinner and had to wait 6 months to get a reply to his invitation. The Soviets were very unforthcoming with any information. They regarded all foreigners as spies, something that was going to be difficult when Allied sailors began arriving in ports like Archangel and Murmansk and found themselves treated as dangerous aliens and restricted from meeting ordinary Soviet citizens. And so you have not complete mutual incomprehension on both sides, but I think you have very limited understanding for both parts, on both parts of how the other side worked. And as I say, you also had the Bolshevik view of the world and how it was going to work, a view that one day revolution would triumph. It had been postponed after 1917. There had been revolutionary outbreaks in much of the world, but those had been suppressed. But the belief, I think, was, certainly among Stalin and his inner circle, was that one day the Soviet Union and its version of revolution would sweep through the world. But in the meantime, they would have to prepare themselves against the attempts by the capitalists to destroy them. They assumed that the capitalists would come back. They would work with them temporarily. They slightly preferred working with the United States. They found the United States less threatening. There was a slightly sentimental version in both the United States and the Soviet Union that somehow the United States and Russia were rather the same. They were both frontiers people. They were both pioneering people. They weren't like the Europeans, stuck in their old ways. There was this famous moment when Stalin was talking after a banquet to the young Yugoslav communist in 1945, Milovan Gilias, and said, you know, with Churchill, he said, he's so mean, he'll put his hand in your pocket even for a kopeck. He said, Roosevelt, and he said it with some admiration, will only go for the big coins. And so there was, perhaps, if the Soviets distinguished between the capitalists they had to deal with, there was a slight feeling the United States, for all its power, was perhaps easier to deal with than Britain and its empire, which they saw as their prime enemy. But what they confidently expected, certainly as the war drew to a close, was that the United States and Britain would for a time get on, but in the nature of capitalists would begin to compete, would begin to want to divide the world, they would eventually fall out, they would fight each other, and then the Soviet Union, by this point much stronger, would be prepared to take on the one that was left. And this, I think, was not a belief that ever really wavered. They also felt, and this was something that ran through the whole of the Second World War, even once they became allies with the British and the Americans, the British and Americans would not be at all sorry to see the Soviet Union bear the brunt, as it did, of fighting against the Germans, not at all sorry to see the Soviet Union weakened by the end of the war. As Stalin said in a telegram to Maisky in 1942, all of us in Moscow have gained the impression that Churchill is aiming at the defeat of the USSR in order then to come to terms with the Germany of Hitler or Brüning, who was a possible right-wing successor to Hitler, at the expense of our country. And throughout the war, the Soviets were always very suspicious that either the British or the Americans or both were going to try and make a separate peace with Germany. In fact, as far as we know, it was only the Soviet Union that contemplated a separate peace, but the suspicion was there that they simply could not trust these people and should not trust these people. And so you had right from the beginning, as you did with the British and American alliance, you had an alliance which was based partly on stereotypes about the other, mutual incomprehension, and issues which divided them, ambitions, competition, and so on. Among the issues that were going to divide them all the way through the war was the issue of resources. Soviet Union feeling that the Americans and the British were holding up things they needed, like tanks, aircraft, trucks, blaming them for not getting the resources there quickly enough. The sea route that the British sent convoys on up to Archangel and Murmansk was, particularly in the summer, enormously dangerous, and the losses were incredibly high. In the long summer days, the Germans were able to see those convoys and inflict dreadful damage on them. And the suspicion in Moscow, at one point, it came out after the war, that they actually believed, or Stalin appeared to believe, that the British were deliberately sailing in the summer months so that the Germans would know where they were and sink the convoys before aid could get to the Soviet Union. This gives you, I think, an idea of the level of suspicion between the two peoples. Another big argument was over strategy. Should there be a second front in Europe, which of course the Soviets desperately needed to take the pressure off them? And if a second front, should it be in the Mediterranean or should it be in France? And increasing the Soviets pushed for a second front in France. And there were disagreements also over whether the war with Japan should have equal priority or lesser priority. How should the war with Japan be conducted? Yet another series of disagreements, and I'll just show you this map again, was going to be over the fate of Europe when the war had ended. And among the issues that were going to be discussed in the many meetings that took place and in the various correspondence that was exchanged, Stalin now became part of the correspondence between Churchill and Roosevelt, was the future of Germany. Should it be dismembered? Should it be occupied? What should happen to it? What sort of reparations should it pay? Another very, very difficult issue which came up very early on was what would happen to the things that the Soviets had gained, the territory the Soviets had gained under the Nazi-Soviet pact. Antony Eden, when he went to Moscow in the autumn of 1941, was rather unpleasantly surprised to discover that the Soviets wanted to keep to the letter of the Ribbentrop-Molotov pact, that everything they had taken in this pact with the Nazis they intended to hang on to. And so this was going to be an issue. Of course, particularly Poland was going to be an issue. For the British, this was a very important point because they had actually gone to war in 1939 to defend Poland, and they didn't want to see it fall into Soviet hands. And the Soviets were equally adamant that they didn't want to see an unfriendly Poland. They had a huge antipathy to Poland. They felt they couldn't trust them. They felt it had always been an avenue of access into Russia. Increasingly, the British dealt with the Soviets, certainly on the fate of the center of Europe. Germany was something the Americans were still interested in, but for the most part, the Americans preferred not to get involved in the details of what would happen to Poland, what would happen to Hungary, what would happen to Romania, and so on. And Roosevelt, on several occasions, probably encouraged Stalin by saying, "I doubt if the United States will be able to keep troops in Europe after the war is over," and giving the impression that for the United States, Europe was not a primary consideration, that he would leave it to the Europeans, in this case the British and the Soviet Union, to sort it out. There was also disagreement over the future world order, and this is something, of course, that Roosevelt was particularly concerned about. As a Wilsonian, he wanted to build a different sort of world order, not something, I think, that Stalin took particularly seriously, something the British were obliged to take seriously, and I think had some sympathy for, but there were to be debates over what sort of world order it would be, how would it be managed. The British, of course, wanted to keep their empire. Churchill had a view that you might have regional councils. There might be a European Council, a Far Eastern Council, an Atlantic Council, which would look after their own areas. This, to the Americans, was too much like spheres of influence, and they weren't prepared to support that. Roosevelt's vision was much more for what eventually became the United Nations and the order that it was to represent. But being Roosevelt, he also, as a realist, I think, which he could be, he also recognized that power mattered And so although he promoted the idea of a United Nations and did his best to bring it about and to ensure that the United States was to become a member of it, which he did successfully, he also believed that in the long run, what he called the four policemen of the world would manage the affairs of the world, would deal with aggression. And those four policemen were to be the British Empire, United States, Soviet Union, and China. And this was something that Roosevelt insisted on in that last case because he felt it would bolster Chiang Kai-shek. And so you have, right from the beginning of the alliance, different views of what should happen when victory comes, different views of what sort of world it should be. What I think the Western allies never fully understood was that although they were prepared to accept that the Soviet Union would have influence among its neighbors, they were not, I think, able to understand, and perhaps this again reflects the lack of communication, just how Stalin intended to exert that influence. I think for Stalin, the idea that a country could be friendly but have a different sort of government from the Soviet Union was something that was very difficult. Again, in one of those conversations with Milovan Gilias, the young Yugoslav communist, he said famously, "Whoever occupies a territory also imposes on it his own social system." And it was to be the degree of control that the Soviets began to impose on the territories they were occupying as the Germans retreated that began to concern the Western allies. I think they had not expected that the Soviet Union would do this. They were quite prepared to see the Soviet Union build a band of secure states around its borders, states whose foreign policies would not threaten that of the Soviet Union, but not prepared to see the Soviet Union take over those states and impose Soviet-style governments on them, which it was beginning to do even before the end of the world. And so in these meetings which were going to take place, you see some of these issues coming out. And of course, there were a great many meetings. There were meetings of foreign ministers, there were meetings with special emissaries, there were meetings with the military, but there were three key meetings of the heads of state. And these meetings, in their own often chaotic ways, were going to help to determine the shape of the peace. The one which is often neglected, but in my view, is actually probably the most important, is Tehran in 1943. People know about Yalta, they know about Potsdam, which came as the war in Europe had ended, but Tehran is perhaps the less well-known, and I think it's worth looking at, and I'm going to do in a bit of detail, because so much of what was discussed at Tehran actually foreshadows what was going to be decided on in subsequent meetings, particularly again at Yalta and Potsdam. The decisions that were made there really set the framework for decisions, by and large, that were going to be made, confirmed and made later on. It was also an important meeting because it was the first time that the three leaders had actually met. Stalin very reluctantly had agreed to come outside the Soviet Union for the first time since he had become, since the 1917 revolution. He hadn't wanted to travel any further, and so Churchill and Roosevelt, Churchill was by far the oldest. Roosevelt, of course, was paraplegic, had to travel long distances in order to meet Stalin. They met in Tehran, and it was, I think, a triumph for Stalin. He charmed Roosevelt. Roosevelt had great faith in his own charm and felt that he could make a friend of Stalin, and was in turn charmed by Stalin. He very deliberately Roosevelt refused to meet privately with Churchill before Tehran. There were meetings in Cairo, and Churchill kept on trying to get an agreed upon agenda, kept on trying to get a common front against Stalin, to try and impose try and promote a common Anglo-American policy, and Roosevelt would have nothing of it. He didn't meet privately with Churchill. He didn't meet privately with him in Tehran until he had met with Stalin. And he very deliberately set himself out to show Stalin that he was not aligned completely with Churchill, that he was deeply sympathetic to the Soviet Union, that he felt they could work together. And as he told one of his cousins later, he said, and there was a cruel side to Roosevelt, he said, I made it clear, he said, when I talked to Stalin, that I wanted to deal with him directly, that I didn't agree with Churchill and everything. And he said, I teased Churchill in the banquets that we had. And he said, Churchill got a bit riled at times, but it was very important to show Stalin that I wasn't taking Churchill all that seriously. It was for Churchill, I think, a very unpleasant recognition of the diminishing power of Britain and the British Empire in the Grand Alliance. It was quite clear now that it was Roosevelt and Stalin. And Roosevelt, I think, in sometimes an often brutal way, made it absolutely clear. Roosevelt stayed at the Soviet embassy. There was a purpose behind this, because the American embassy was quite far out and there were worries about security, having Roosevelt drive through very crowded streets. But the Soviet Union offered its embassy to Roosevelt, which Roosevelt accepted. The rooms were bugged. This was, I think, whether or not the Americans knew it, the Soviets were listening to everything they said. But again, I think it was, if Roosevelt knew it, he may have suspected it. It was a demonstration that he wanted to build trust and a trusting relationship with Stalin. He met Stalin alone, refusing again Churchill's demands to meet before they had the first plenary. He met Stalin alone. He didn't have an agenda. This surprised the Soviets, who were used to very formal agendas. Roosevelt said, no, we just are here really to get to know each other, to explore common things. And Roosevelt did in this meeting with Stalin, through interpreters, of course, what he often did in the United States, and he thought out loud. And he said, you know, the French shouldn't get back Indochina. I think the British Empire really should be wound up. He didn't put it in quite those words. And of course, for Stalin, who every word was deliberate, this seemed to be a very clear indication of American policy. When the plenaries met, a number of the topics which I mentioned came up. The Second Front came up. And here Stalin put real pressure on the British, who were delaying, who were hoping to perhaps open a second front in the Mediterranean to pursue the Italian campaign, or perhaps even move further into the eastern end of the Mediterranean. Churchill was very reluctant to do a seaborne landing on the French coast. He was aware of the cost that would impose in terms of loss of life, and he was very reluctant to do it. But Churchill was, in a sense, outvoted by Roosevelt and Stalin. Stalin very bluntly said, second front, it's got to be in France. It doesn't make sense anywhere else. And Roosevelt, of course, backed him up. They also talked, and so this was to be the result 2 years later of that decision, the D-Day landings in Normandy in June 1944, a decision that was forced on the British. They were forced to give a commitment to it at Tehran in 1943. They also talked about Japan, and the Soviets gave a promise that they would come in to the war with Japan once Germany had been defeated, a promise that they were eventually going to keep. China came up, and Stalin approved a Far East settlement, making sure that the Soviet Union got what it wanted. He indicated future Soviet demands would be made on South Sakhalin Island and the Kuril Islands. Eastern Europe came up, and again, the Soviets, nothing firm was decided, but the Soviets were left with the impression that they did not intend to interfere with the Soviet Union in the neighboring countries, that they would give the Soviets a free hand in those countries. Poland also came up. And this was, of course, as I mentioned, a very difficult one for the British. But here, Churchill actually made a terrific concession to Stalin. He had a private conversation with him. And he said, look, we all know that the Soviet Union needs to be compensated with territory taken from Poland, compensated for what it lost during the war. And Germany deserves to lose territory. And so pulling out three matches, Churchill showed how Poland could be moved westwards, which is in the end what was going to happen. Poland was going to move about 200 miles westwards, a decision that was finally confirmed at Potsdam. But the ground for that decision was laid in Tehran. A lot of these details would be worked out later, but the concessions, I think, were crucial. The British tried after Tehran to pull back a bit on giving a great deal of Polish territory to the Soviet Union and moving Poland into German territory, but at that point it was too late. There was also discussion in Tehran of whether Germany should be dismembered, divided up into a number of states, or what should happen to it. France also came up, should France be treated as an enemy or as an ally now that it had been liberated? Churchill was all for restoring France as a great power. Roosevelt and Stalin had a very strong view that they didn't particularly want to see that happen, and neither of them had any enthusiasm for de Gaulle. And then the future of world organizations also came up at Tehran. All nations would be represented in this new organization, but there'd be a small executive committee with the big four, Great Britain, the United States, Soviet Union, and China, and various other arrangements would be made to put representatives of different areas on it. And so Tehran, although there were going to be a great many discussions after Tehran, really, I think, shaped the post-war world, and I think shaped that relationship now with Britain very much the junior partner, and the Soviet Union and the United States very much the senior one. And so Yalta, in January 1945, was again going to deal with these subjects, but was going to be within the framework of what had been discussed at Tehran and in subsequent meetings. And here you see the three great leaders, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin, all of them considerably aged by the war. But if you look at Roosevelt, you see just how ill he looks. He was going to die just 4 months later. He was going to die 2 months, 3 months later in April. And it has been said, and those there at the meeting said, that he was not always on his best form, that he often rambled, that he often didn't seem to know what he was doing. I don't go so far as to say that he gave away unnecessarily what he shouldn't have done. I think, you know, Yalta is often seen as a betrayal, but I think what we always have to remember is what was happening on the ground. Soviet forces were now crossing Germany's borders. They were in possession of a good deal of the center of Europe. Their armies were the ones on the ground, and that gave them a very, very strong argument. Churchill had tried to deal with increased Soviet power in the agreement, where he'd discussed with Stalin in December 1944 what would happen to the newly liberated countries, newly liberated from Germany, and had proposed that the Soviets have dominance in certain countries, Romania, for example, Hungary, Bulgaria, the British and the Soviets go 50-50 in Yugoslavia, and that the British have predominant power or influence in Greece. And he'd scribbled this on the back of an envelope, and Stalin had ticked it in agreement. And what Churchill was trying to do was recover, I think, what had been conceded to the Soviets, and trying to deal with the fact of Soviet power on the ground. The United States, again, very detached on this, not particularly wanting to get involved. Again, Roosevelt making it clear that he had no intention of keeping an American military presence in Europe after the war was over. And so Yalta, which was a rambling set of conversations, didn't achieve perhaps all that much, but again, a number of advances were made. The Soviet Union now made a firm promise to enter the war against Japan. The Poles, Poland was really conceded as a Soviet territory. In a sort of face-saving arrangement, the British and the Americans persuaded the Soviets to agree to a declaration on liberated Europe, which talked about the prospects of democracy in a new Europe. This did not mesh very well, go very well with what was actually happening on the ground, where Soviet power was now being imposed. And the Soviets were now beginning to round up and arrest non-communist leaders. The Polish government, which was recognized by the Soviet government in January 1945, was made up the so-called Lublin Poles, communist Poles, who had been brought essentially with the Soviet armies and were now imposed as a government on Poland. The Polish government in exile in London, and therefore called the London Poles, was increasingly marginalized. A number of them made the fatal mistake of going to Moscow to talk to the Soviets about some form of coalition government, and were not seen again until they appeared in show trials. The Soviets were making it very clear by their actions on the grounds that they intended, as Stalin had said, to impose their own social system on the peoples of Central Europe, and they did not intend to have any coalition governments with elements that would not be friendly to the Soviet Union. And so, just a nice cartoon, the world, how is it doing by 1945? And I think the answer is not all that well, but could anything have been done better? Roosevelt himself was becoming increasingly gloomy about cooperation with the Soviets in his last days before he died. He said to a friend, "We can't do business with Stalin. He has broken every one of the promises he made at Yalta." And I think Stalin, in effect, knew that if he broke his promises, there would likely be very little pushback from either Britain or the United States. Roosevelt died, and President Truman took over, his vice president. He had not been briefed properly by Roosevelt. He'd not been prepared for the prospect that he might take over. He was, however, prepared, I think, more than Roosevelt was, to get tough with the Soviets. Roosevelt, I think, hoped, perhaps really till the end, that he could somehow win the Soviet Union over, he could somehow win Stalin over, he could somehow make the Soviet Union part of a world order, and that eventually the Soviet Union would change. He had great faith in convergence, later on to become a political science theory, that the Soviet Union would gradually mellow, become more democratic, become more capitalist, become more like the United States, and that eventually the United States and the Soviet Union would be converging in the ways in which they looked at the world. The United States might become a bit more socialist. In some ways, Roosevelt's New Deal introduced elements of socialism into the United States, and this was a faith, I think, that Roosevelt had. Was he naive? Was there anything he could have done differently? Of course. But again, I think we have to go back to the facts on the ground. And the Soviets were the predominant military power in the heart of Europe. And there was very little that the Allies could do about this. Well, the final, I'll just go very quickly. The final meeting was at Potsdam. Roosevelt, of course, not there. Now Harry Truman. This is the surrender of Germany, the Soviets, British, and Americans celebrating the surrender of Germany in May 1945. And then in July 1945, the meeting at Potsdam with a new cast, which was rapidly to become an even newer cast because the general election in Britain put Churchill out of office, something that stunned the Soviets. They never understood it. They never understood how this could have happened. They thought it must have been some sort of coup. And Attlee came as British representative. It was clear at Potsdam that all those tensions and disagreements that had been there were now increasingly out in the open. Truman was tougher than Roosevelt had ever been with the Soviets. He had a meeting before Potsdam with Molotov in Washington, and Molotov, in which he berated Molotov for the various broken promises and actions of the Soviets in the center of Europe. And Molotov, for once, was shaken and said, "I've never been spoken to like that." And Truman said, "You'll be spoken like that again." He was much more prepared, I think, to be tough. I think by this point, a lot of Americans, the British perhaps had come to the point earlier, a lot of Americans had come to the point that they could not work with the Soviet Union, that they had tried, that they had continued to try, but the Soviets simply were obdurate. The Soviets had their own policies and they were not prepared to budge for them. Well, the war ended in Asia in August with the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There was still hope that the UN, here is the British ambassador, Lord Halifax, signing the UN Charter in the spring of 1945. There still was hope that the new organization of the United Nations, which the Soviet Union had agreed to join, would be able to bring some sort of stability and order to the world. And that hope was only to be partially filled. And by 1947, we had the division of the world into the Soviet bloc and the American bloc. And we had the Americans doing what they had thought they would never do, bringing troops back to Europe. So how much of this is the result of what happened in the Second World War? I'd say a lot. A lot of it is conditioned by what happened. Could it have turned out differently? Well, I'll leave you to disagree with me. Thank you.
Thanks, Margaret. That's absolutely wonderful. I've got so many questions and so many comments, but I won't make too many. But I will follow the great tradition of Christopher Coker and ask a question and make a comment. You rightly stress the extraordinary divisions within that triple alliance, putting China aside for one second, but within that triple alliance. And indeed, the only reason it came into being is because Japan attacked the United States in December of 41 and the Nazi Germany attacked the Soviet Union in June. It may not have even happened without the attacks on the United States by both Germany, etc. So it was a weird alliance, and did many people have much hope it would last? I doubt it somehow. I always thought that throughout it, there was a kind of an underlying assumption that something, it wasn't going to last. I don't know. But the important point is, all three had their differences, but I would say the differences between the United States and the UK and British Empire were kind of first order differences with the Soviet Union. You know, they were systemic, they were fundamental. There was the Comintern, which had been abolished in 43, but to be replaced later by the Cominform. There were communist parties, it was a different system. altogether, and it wasn't capitalist. Seems to me the differences between the United States and the British, whatever, they were real, the differences were real. I would almost call them of a second order, though. Mm. I would call them of a second order. Yeah. You know, whatever they disagreed about, and they were big, you know, and it indeed became pretty clear at the Bretton Woods on the structure of the post-World War II economy, which Keynes, of course, was much involved in, as you know. You know, they had a shared history, problematic, but it was there. I suppose there's that old boring thing called language. They understood each other. They could talk to each other regularly. You go up to the old US embassy, which is now becoming the most expensive hotel in the world. You know, the Brits were always in and out of there. There was a lot of sharing of everything, intelligence-wise. You know, it was pretty intimate all the time, and the Brits were constantly going over there. You know, it was an intimacy which, just as you described very well, simply impossible with the Soviet Union. And I suppose in the end, to put it rather crudely and structurally, they were both capitalist and, in a sense, liberal democracies. So I just think that was a kind of, there were second order differences compared to the first order differences. Yeah. And I think that would then explain why it was after the war, whatever their differences remained, and they were real, I'm sure you know that better than I do, they nonetheless could come back together. So I just, reflection on that, yeah. If you could.
Yeah.
Just get your kind of thoughts on that to start off with.
Yeah, there were differences within a family.
Yeah.
I think you're right. But that family differences can often be quite bitter. And, you know, I think the Americans, Roosevelt sort of made a point. I mean, he did this, I think it was at Tehran, yeah. And they were all drinking toasts, as they tended to do. They spent a lot of time eating. You know, they always said Vienna danced. Well, they ate in the conferences, yeah. In the Second World, yeah. War. Yeah. And they were toasting, you know, the glorious Soviet Union or whatever. And someone proposed a toast to King George, and Roosevelt said, I can't drink it. I will not drink a toast to the British monarch. My ancestors fought against the British crown. So, you know, the differences ran fairly deep. And I think there were, yeah. Often these mutual suspicions. I mean, well, I know the military always need to make plans, but the American military, particularly the Army, less so the Navy, but it was sometimes the Navy in the 20s and 30s, drew up war plans for a war with the British Empire.
Including Canada. Yeah, just in case we forget that.
Yeah. You know, we actually had a brilliant war plan which would have stopped the Americans in their tracks.
But
we were going to attack suddenly before they knew what was going to hit them.
A preemptive strike by Canada on the United States.
Down the Mississippi Valley.
Yeah.
Divide the United States in half before the Americans realized what had happened, then they'd sue for peace. Anyway, it didn't happen.
But I'm glad you didn't do that.
No, well, we might have had trouble carrying it out, but in any case, yeah. You know, it was not inconceivable to serious-minded people on both sides that the United States and Britain might actually go to war.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to remember that. But you're right. I mean, I think the difference, nevertheless, between the Soviet Union and the Western allies is of a different order, because it represents a different way of thinking. Yeah. I mean, I really think that ideology is crucial in understanding how Stalin saw the world. I mean, he was immersed in it, he wrote it, he took his own writings very seriously. I mean, this was not something that he just did as window dressing. I think it was something he sincerely believed in. I mean, I think he believed that one day there would be the revolution that had been promised, the worldwide revolution that had been promised. Mm. And although he dissolved the Communist International, Comintern, he kept its structure and he kept its personnel. And when he reinstituted what was called the Cominform after the Second World War, basically the same people popped up in key posts. And I do think I think this is important. I mean, Vladimir Zubok, Professor Zubok, has this very interesting concept of revolutionary imperialism. Mm. That for Stalin, he was a Russian nationalist, even though he was a Georgian. And interestingly, during the war, he more and more used the term Russia, which no one else was allowed to use to stand in for the Soviet Union. But I think it fused in his mind that Russia was the forefront of the worldwide revolution, that the Russians were the most active and best revolutionaries, and therefore spreading Russian influence was actually spreading worldwide revolution. And these two were sort of fused in his mind. And so I think, yes, I think you're looking at two very different ways of looking at the world. I mean, the Americans look at the world, they have this prejudice. I mean, they disagree on how the world should be organized, and they disagree. They believe that the British believe in something they loathe called spheres of influence. Mm. although I've never understood how spheres of influence are different from the Monroe Doctrine, quite frankly. But anyway, you know, the Americans, when the Americans want to have dominance in their own neighborhood. But in any case, the Americans may have disagreed with the mechanisms of how the world might be organized, but they shared a belief in process, they shared a belief in liberal values with the British. No, so I think that is, I think, very important. I think, you know, that you can come together in an alliance for a certain purpose, as they did in the Second World War. You can actually work together quite well. But in the end, that alliance isn't going to stick because you simply have such different views of the world. And I think the Soviets never thought in the end they would be able to work with the British and the Americans.
Just one final, a quick follow-up on that, Margaret. Is it therefore your opinion that if it had not been for the Cold War, the United States and the UK would not have formed the kind of alliance they did after 1947, 48, through the Marshall Plan, through NATO, and everything alliance, or was it values and shared other outlook?
Well, I've often thought the key thing, I mean, look, the United States wanted to get its troops home after the Second World War. It wanted to dismantle a lot of the military apparatus that it set up. I mean, it dissolved the OSS, the Office of Strategic Studies. It dissolved its intelligence agency. Mm. It cut back defense spending dramatically, as you know. And so I think from the point of view of the Americans is, you know, they'd done it, the war was over, they'd won it, that was it. The world could get on, and they could get on with doing what they did best, and that would be trading and investment and looking after the American public. And I've always thought, but I'm sure many would disagree with me, that if Stalin had set out to persuade the Americans to stay in Europe, he couldn't have done a better job of it.
He did a great job, yeah.
You know, that it was what he was doing. I think the Czech coup, for example, you know, the ways in which the Soviets were destroying, unnecessarily actually, because the Czech government was thoroughly prepared to work with the Soviet Union. Beneš had made that absolutely clear. You know, that there was the Finnish model, which was the only one the Soviets seemed to have managed to deal with that they didn't absolutely control. But I think it was what the Soviets began to do that persuaded the Americans that they were going to have to deal seriously. And of course, what really I think, I mean, NATO, the treaty was signed in 1949, it was the Korean War, which really militarized NATO, which really brought the forces, the American forces back. Mm. You know, the Canadians were the same. The Canadians had no intention of keeping forces in Europe, and we brought them back. We kept them there. So,
Well, Stalin, like Putin, has been very good for NATO. You know? Okay, we've got a lot of different questions coming up. Do we have a microphone?
You do, I think.
Where is our mic? Do we only have the one microphone? Gosh, it's the cuts, you know, it's the cuts. There's a gentleman over here with a hat on. Can I identify as...
Very happy. Okay. Well, thank you very much for this wonderful talk, and it's been very enlightening. My question is just quickly about the Grand Alliance that you described. I think it's very important to detail the USA was very much pro-Nazi before World War II. Bush family, the oil companies, Henry Ford, who was obviously one of Hitler's most favoured capitalist and had a picture of him on his desk, and also they were very in favour and helping to fund other elements across the world as well, of course, but fundamentally the USA was happily funding Germany. So I'm just, this Grand Alliance, one of them in this Grand Alliance was a massive fan of Hitler, and I'm just curious why you felt that.
Okay, we'll
sorry, the question is, why did you choose to edit that bit of history out?
Oh, I don't think there's any editing out. I think it's
important.
Well, I don't deny it's important, but we've got other people here who will ask questions, and Margaret will no doubt answer your question. There's a gentleman here, please.
Thank you very much. You talked about three countries. You talked about the USA, the Soviet Union, and the UK. And then at certain stages, two others entered in, which were China and France, who actually, sort of by the time we get to the United Nations, are playing an important role. Can you say how these entered into the alliance a bit more, or what the post-war alliance actually was?
Okay, we've got a China and France. Yep. We've got a pro-Nazi. And the gentleman here, please, in the middle. I'll take these three, and then we'll Q&A.
Okay, I suppose the common thread is George Marshall. It would be around the Allied strategy and the surrender of Japan. and the role of the dropping of the bomb versus the Soviet invasion of Manchuria. And then I suppose chronologically that leads to Marshall being sent to China from 1945 to 47 to broker peace between the communists and the KMT and ultimately try and stop the communists from taking over there.
Okay, that's great. We've got about seven questions there altogether. But yeah. Margaret, do you want to pick up on what you want to answer? Maybe okay. The first one, start with that one. Is that gentleman there?
Yeah, well, I could have told you the whole history of the 20s and 30s, but we'd be here in sleeping bags. yeah. You know, so... just let me say something about... you know, there were certainly those in the United States, as there were in Britain, who thought that the Nazis initially... Yeah. As they thought the Italian fascists were good for their countries. They were pulling their socks up. They were sort of getting the trains running on time. That changed very markedly, particularly in the case of Germany after Kristallnacht. And American opinion, and Gallup polls had come in by now, and American opinion, public opinion shifts very markedly after Kristallnacht in 1938. There is horror in the United States at what's happening. And yes, there are still people like Lindbergh and Henry Ford, but they are outliers increasingly. And the United States was, I think, far less sympathetic and helpful to the Nazis than the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union, which signed a treaty in 1939, not only fulfilled the terms of that treaty, it overfulfilled them. Mm. Right up until pretty much the day of Barbarossa, it was shipping equipment and raw materials and metals to the Germans. The German war machine, I think, really depended to a great extent on what it was extracting from both the center of Europe, from Romania, for example, but also from the Soviet Union. Yes. I've always found it odd, Stalin, who trusted no one in the world, not even his pet parrot, trusted Hitler, and it, you know, of all people to trust. Anyway, the United States, all the opinion polls show that the United States public opinion is increasingly sympathetic to the Allies, increasingly sympathetic to Britain, particularly once the Blitz starts. Something like 93% of the Americans in a poll done in September 1939 want to see the British survive and win. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think, we can mistake a few people, often very public figures, but if you look at the underlying trends, I think it is very much sympathetic. Now, China and France were to be included in the new United Nations. The United States, Roosevelt was very keen that China should become a player. And this view of the four policemen, China would be the policeman in Asia. And this was done partly to prop up the nationalist government against the communists. But I think the Americans had for long seen China as a country that they wanted to protect and foster, certainly since the 1930s and the Japanese invasion. And so China was to become a member of the Security Council, permanent member of the Security Council, as was France. France, however, was there on the insistence of the British. The British wanted France reestablished as a European power. They did not have much sympathy from either the Soviets or the Americans. The Americans and the Soviets were very reluctant to concede anything to France. They didn't want France to have an occupation zone in Germany when Germany surrendered. And it was the British, again, who insisted that France be one of the four occupying powers. And so what I think both China and France were brought in partly because they had sponsors, but interestingly enough, neither Chiang Kai-shek nor de Gaulle came to any of the big three meetings. Roosevelt met Chiang Kai-shek before in Cairo, but Chiang Kai-shek was not invited to Tehran, and de Gaulle, once France was liberated, was not invited to either Tehran, Yalta, or Potsdam. The British suggested it, and they simply got nowhere with the Americans and the Russians. As far as the role of General Marshall, I think, which is what you were asking about, Marshall, you know, is one of these fascinating characters who contributes enormously to the American war effort. As chief of staff, he stays in Washington. He had, I think, very much wanted to be put in charge of the Normandy landings. He made Supreme Commander in Europe. And Roosevelt said, I need you in Washington. And Marshall, who was, I think, probably one of the more decent people in history, accepted this. I mean, he really was a good soldier. But he was absolutely selfless. He was an extraordinary man. As far as the, if I get your question, the dropping of the bomb, on Japan, which did end the war very quickly indeed. And this was not a controversial decision at the time. It became controversial later on, but it was something both Truman and Marshall supported. They simply felt that the war had to be brought to an end quickly. I mean, they were already planning for a war going on until 46, and they foresaw a tremendous loss of life, both American but also Japanese. And so they saw the bomb simply as a weapon that could be used to end the war and impress upon the Japanese that they had lost. It only, I think, was afterwards that the world began to regard it with the horror that it came to regard it. And, and there were questions about it. Had the Americans dropped it to try and show the Soviets they had this weapon? Soviets, in fact, already knew because they had extremely good spies. And in fact, Truman had told Stalin about it at Potsdam because there'd been the successful test at Alamogordo had taken place during the Potsdam conference. So I think, you know, to go back to General Marshall, I think he deserves, I don't know if you, if anyone here is interested, I think he deserves a new biography. I think he's a wonderful man, and I wish someone would do a biography. Unfortunately, I don't think he kept a diary, which is always a nuisance, but anyway.
And was also associated with a rather important plan in 1947-48 called the Marshall Plan. I've got a lot of hands going up. I'll take the gentleman here, because he's had his hand up a long time, if you could say. Please, very brief and to the point. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. Thank you. As we know, Germany declared war on the United States in December 1941. So my question is, had that not happened, would the United States, in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor, have declared war on Germany?
Okay. Thank you, Germany. Yeah. Let's take a young chap here, Identified as young. Yeah. You should be happy with that.
Yeah. Young chap on the microphone, thanks.
Young chap on the mic now, thank you.
So you were mentioning that all the Allied powers, the great powers, had their own maybe secret agenda in a sense, driven by sort of more national-based directions and directives that they've had in the war. One of the things that you've mentioned regarding the U.S. policy in peace times is obviously the commercial part of it, the investment into Europe, into new markets without any sort of dominance, especially military dominance. And you were very right to point out the Tehran Conference as being the crucial sort of connector in shaping how the US and British concessions were made in regards to Central Europe. But it was obvious even at that point to me that the Americans would not be able to invest in that part of Europe, nor they would be able to conduct any sort of business the way that the Soviet ideology would work if those concessions were made that early. And quite factually, around the time of the Warsaw Uprising, we can see on one side, one coast of the Vistula River that divides the city into two, and the Soviet troops already taking the city away from Germans, but letting the fight go on the other side, while in Lublin, South Poland, there's already a communist government being prepared and already the first sort of revolutionary parade being thrown. And going 7-8 years further into a completely different part of the world, we see Japan, that was completely overrun by Americans and governed by the Americans ever since its collapse, but they were... That changed with China going communist, and that changed with Korea and the Korean War.
Is there a question?
Yeah. So the question is: the question is, would you say that the Tehran Conference had long-lasting implications on the Cold War divide, not only in Europe but in, you know, in the global scale?
So on economics, I think it. I'll take one over here. From you, Mary. Get some gender balance in here for a while. Yeah.
Thank you very much for that.
Mary Calder.
And, I mean, your argument that the sort of division of Europe into different social systems was kind of inevitable as a consequence of the wartime alliance, to me, is very convincing. But what I wonder is, was it inevitable that those differences would be militarized? Was it inevitable that those differences would be militarized?
I mean,
the Soviet Union undoubtedly posed a threat to Eastern Europe, but did it really pose a threat to Western Europe? The troops that were in Eastern Europe were needed to keep Eastern Europe down. And so, you know, it seems to me that that's the big issue, because the militarization of that difference really made it very difficult to get change. And you might have had more change after Stalin died had it not been so firmly embedded.
So your argument, Mary, or your question is basically the Cold War was almost inevitable, almost, but militarization is what really cemented it for a much longer period, maybe, than otherwise might have been.
Yeah.
You've got a number of questions there, I think, to do. And I'm going to bring as many people in as possible. Don't worry. I've seen every hand.
And I'll try and be brief, too. But on the US and Germany question, I think the United States, my own view is it would not have come into the war without Hitler's declaration of war. You know, that Roosevelt was always careful never to move too far ahead of American public opinion.
Yeah.
He was always concerned about Congress. He'd actually had some quite difficult moments with Congress in the course of 1941, and I think he was not going to stick his neck out and declare war on Germany. His mind was made up by Hitler's decision to declare war on the United States. Hitler thought war was going to come with the U.S. sooner or later, and he thought you might as well get it over with. There's quite a good new book by Brendan Sims and Charlie Lederman about this. And I think, you know, I think without that declaration of war, the United States would have continued to support Britain but not come into the war. And the outcome might have been very different. You know, whether the British could have hung on and whether the Battle of the Atlantic would have gone in favor of the British is a big question mark. On the economic components of the visions that the people had for the post-war world, yes, they all had views of how the post-war war economy and how their role in it was going to work. What the United States wanted, I think they were less concerned with the center of Europe and more concerned with the British Empire. What they wanted was an end to imperial preference. They wanted access to the markets. They were, by 1945, I think they represented half the world's manufacturing capacity. And I think they were also, people were aware that at the end of the First World War there'd been a slump as governments had cut back spending dramatically, and I think there was concern there'd be a slump in unemployment again, and I think one of the ways to avoid this was by exporting. And so I think this was something very much in their consideration. Interestingly enough, the Soviet Union also thought that the capitalists would be in trouble with a slump, and they thought the United States was going to have to invest. They thought the United States would continue lend-lease. I mean, they seemed confidently to have thought that the United States needed to find a home for capital, and what better place than the center of Europe and the Soviet Union. And as far as the British were concerned, I think they were very much overwhelmed by debt. And I think one of the reasons certainly Churchill wanted to hang on to the empire was to try and deal with that. On the militarization of the Cold War, yes, I think it's a very interesting question. What I think counted were the perceptions at the time, you know, that there was real fear in the West, that there was, the British had already begun to think of a possible war with the Soviet Union even before the end of the war. Churchill had ordered plans for a possible war against the Soviet Union to be drawn up. And I think the concern was of the Western European countries was that if the Soviet Union actually decided to keep on rolling west, and it might have done. I mean, there's a very telling remark that Stalin made to someone. Someone said, you know, it's wonderful. You've done what Tsar Alexander I did in defeating Napoleon and getting, you know, you're in Berlin. And Stalin said, yes, but Alexander I got to Paris. And whether, you know, it depends what you make of Stalin. And, of course, he remains a mystery because there's so much we don't know about him. But would Stalin have continued to probe? I mean, my own sense is he was an opportunist. If he had seen the possibility to move, I mean, he had this vision that Germany might be united under Soviet rule or under Soviet influence. You know, if he'd seen opportunities, would he have continued to take them? I don't think we'll ever know, but I do think the perceptions at the time in the West were that the Soviets were a threat, and there was also deep concern about the large communist parties in countries, particularly Italy and France. And so I think the apprehension was that the Soviet Unions were not going to stop. And the ways the center of Europe, I think, deepened those apprehensions. You know, the death of Jan Masaryk, which I think was an assassination, the Czech foreign minister, coup in Czechoslovakia. You know, I think all of this, the arrests, the people disappearing in the night, the bodies being found in the rivers and canals in Berlin, all of this, I think, help to persuade policymakers and indeed a lot of public opinion in the West that the Soviets would take advantage if they could, and through a combination possibly of military pressure and internal subversion. And as I say, we never can be quite sure what Stalin's intentions really were, because he kept things very close to himself. So yes, I don't know. I mean, it is possible. And it, there was a sort of faint window of possibility, funnily enough, of all people from Beria, after Stalin's death, who actually wanted to dismantle some of the bring down the level of conflict in the Cold War and begin to work with the West. But as we know, he ended in the Lubyanka being shot. So, you know, it is an interesting question. I don't have an answer to it because the possibilities were certainly for it to have gone in a slightly different way. But Korea, I think, was decisive in militarizing it. Once Korea happened, that's when the Americans brought troops back into Europe.
Also, Margaret, just to add an additional empirical point, 1949, the Soviet Union detonated an atomic bomb.
Yeah, yeah.
And it did it years before anybody had ever anticipated to do so. Yeah. American and British intelligence were saying they wouldn't get anything until about 1955.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think, again, that would shake anybody, yeah. I think. Look, there's lots of hands, but there's not lots of time. So I'm going to take a young man here, another young man. They're all over the place. Okay, who else? As you get older, everybody else looks younger. I think it's all relative, you know. No.
Thank you. So you mentioned a lot about power dynamics in your talk, and it reminded me of Bismarck's apt phrase that every alliance has a rider and a horse. Was there ever this mentality within the Grand Alliance, within one of the leaders, that their country was sort of the most important one of the alliance, that without their contribution, be it economic, manpower, or even political, the Grand Alliance would fall apart? And if so, did it ever reflect itself in that leader's interactions with the other Grand Alliance leaders or at the conferences, perhaps?
Okay, all right. I've got the question coming here. Please, one in here. The gentleman with the pink shirt. This is how I'm identifying people.
Not a young man.
Not so young. but not too old.
No, that's something you can make to say. If I could just briefly say, do you have anything to say about the non-Grand Alliance? Why did Germany, Japan and Italy and their allies not form a more effective front?
Okay.
Now, I'm going to
was that purely personal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
I've got one question. The gentleman at the back's had his hand up for the last 35 minutes. In the middle there, that's the gentleman there, please. Sorry about that. You're coming in now, last question, and then we'll go for a drink.
Thank you very much. I made a lot of notes. I've worked on a number of EU programs in Ukraine. In 2007, I had a conversation with the EU political advisor in Chisinau in Moldova. He was not aware that Kiev had been under German occupation in the Second World War. People may wish to draw their conclusions from that. There's very dark stories there. My question is, and it's got some salience to the present situation, you mentioned how in, I think, the autumn or maybe very late summer of 1941, Britain and America concluded that the Soviet Union would hold out. Why was that? Was it essentially based on German logistical overstretch or what they were hearing from Moscow? Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, I think we'll have to end all the questions there, Margaret.
Okay.
You have a few minutes to answer and then reception.
I mean, Bismarck's remark is classic, the rider and the horse. And, of course, he always wanted Germany or Prussia and then Germany to be the rider and poor Austria to be the horse. In the case of the Grand Alliance and the Second World War, I think Britain is clearly the subordinate partner, the junior partner by Tehran by 1943. But as far as Soviet Union and the United States are concerned, I think they each bring different things to the alliance, and they're each extremely important. I mean, without Soviet manpower, without the tremendous loss of life suffered by the Soviet Union, the war would not have been won on the ground in Europe. And the Soviet losses are just of a magnitude so much greater than the losses of the Allied, the Western Allies. But without American resources, without American equipment, something like it was 10% of all the planes in the Soviet Air Force were American planes. Mm. The Soviet Army moved on American trucks and in American jeeps, American oil. You know, these things were absolutely essential to the war effort. So without that, I think each of Stalin and Roosevelt recognized the power of the other. My own view is Stalin was the more effective negotiator because he knew what he wanted. And Roosevelt tended to behave very much as he behaved in American domestic politics, throwing out ideas and telling different people different things, which didn't work with someone like Stalin. I mean, the Soviets simply had an agenda and they stuck to it and they kept pushing it. And if they didn't achieve it at one meeting, they'd simply come back to it at the next meeting. whereas I think the American diplomacy was more divided and less directed and less under control than the Soviet the Soviet Union was. As far as the Axis powers go, it's very interesting. They never developed into a working alliance in the same way that the Grand Alliance did. And that was partly because of distance. Really, it was two separate wars they were involved in. Japan was fighting its war in the east. The Germans had very little interest in what was going on. There was very little communication between them. It was more a demonstration effect or a demonstration of friendship than anything real. I mean, if you look at, there was very little coordination in strategy, and very little exchange of information, very little material aid sent. As for Italy, it engaged in expeditions in the Balkans and in North Africa, which the Germans had not particularly wanted it to do, and then got into trouble, which drew German resources in. And I think the Italians had come bitterly to regret that they'd ever been dragged along by Germany, certainly by 1943, which why, of course, there was the overthrow of Mussolini's government. And it never involved that degree of close cooperation. I mean, Mussolini and Hitler did meet, but the meetings were not always all that comfortable ones. Just a detail which I can never resist mentioning, but when Mussolini was overthrown, he was imprisoned on an Italian island, I forget the name, and Hitler sent him for his birthday the complete works of Nietzsche in German, which Mussolini didn't read.
Wow.
Yeah, which maybe says something about their understanding of each other.
Yeah. Maybe Hitler had a sense of humor, I don't know.
Now, Ukraine, I'm trying to remember what the question was. Ukraine came up. Oh, yes, sorry, why? Yes.
Was the Soviet Union to go under?
Yes, you mentioned Ukraine, my mind was turning to that. I mean, one of the things that strikes me so much is when you read about the Second World War, the same place names are coming up again today. And indeed, some of the same stories about the ways in which the now Russian armies are fighting seem eerily reminiscent of what happened in the Second World War. I think it was partly the resistance of the Soviets, partly the fact that they moved the government 900 miles away from Moscow, but Stalin stayed in Moscow. It was quite clear they were preparing for a long struggle. Partly, I think, because the Soviet resistance was so dogged, and the regime didn't fall. You know, I think all of this, there were still Soviets fighting in the fall of 1945. Harry Hopkins, the peripatetic Harry Hopkins, who flew everywhere representing Roosevelt, had played much the same function in Britain in the summer of 1940. In January 1941, and he'd reported back to Roosevelt that the British were determined to fight on, and he went to Moscow in the summer of 1940 and made exactly the same assessment, and said they are prepared to fight on. And they're absolutely determined to fight on. And so I think it was the Soviet determination to fight on, and possibly, but I haven't come across it, someone else may have, an assessment that the longer the Germans were there, the more likely they were to get into trouble, which of course is what happened. You know, that they if they couldn't conclude the war by the winter, then they were going to be in trouble, which is indeed what happened.
Yeah. Okay, I think, thank you very much for those excellent answers, Margaret. I'm going to bring it to a conclusion. I hear the wonderful clink of bottles at the back, which is always very distracting. First of all, I'd like to thank you all for coming along tonight. I think this is the second Engelsberg where it's been face-to-face, but it's been pure face-to-face tonight. And as you said, Margaret, at the very beginning, how much more satisfying and nice it is to see real people rather than screens looking at you. Yeah. So it's really nice to have us all back together again. Let's hope that it lasts. But thank you also for all your various questions, provocative and otherwise, young or old. So thank you very, very much indeed. It's been a wonderful occasion from that point of view. It's great to have a collective intellectual exercise. And from a personal point of view, I think that's great, largely because I generally talk too much. But that's another question. Secondly, I'd like once again to say thank you to Axel Jonsson Foundation for this very generous support. A good friend is here this evening, so thank you very much for all that you've done for LSE Ideas and this wonderful series that we have been able to put on. I say we because I still feel myself to be part of Ideas, of course. Not that I'm directing it any longer. That is why Christopher's looking a little bit older tonight, all this hard work he's doing on behalf of Ideas. I won't say that's why I'm looking younger, but that's another question. But thank you so much. It's a great generous, and I know the great work that you do. And we really appreciate it, and I genuinely mean that, of course. But last but by no means least, another tour de force by the wonderful Margaret McMillan. How does she do it? She's absolutely fantastic. Yes. No, not at all. Not at all. So, the clink of bottles. Is it champagne tonight, Christopher, or do we have the usual? The Chateau Neuf du Pape 88. Good. Very good. What do you got?
Please fill out feedback forms if you have a minute. The box is at the drinks table.